From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 8th, 1960, when Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho was released. Hitchcock had limited the promotion for the film, not wanting the stars to give away any of the film's plot twists, and Hitchcock insisted that theaters not allow customers to arrive late for the film. Now, at first, there was a little resistance, but shortly after the release, there were long lines and high demand for Psycho. No one was going to be late for this one. Now, Hitchcock had promised something different, something new, something more terrifying. He achieved it, many say, with a combination of storytelling, editing, from the iconic shower scene to the reveal of the true nature of Norman Bates' mother. Well, next week, the Little Theater is hosting another edition of Science on Screen. 1 week from tonight, you can watch Psycho. And we were just talking about this earlier today. If you're someone who hasn't seen Psycho, like our intern, Kate Cowie Haskell, and you don't know, look at Val LeBanc. You're shaking your head. Val, you've seen it, haven't you? Oh, of course, yeah. I was thinking of Kate Cowie Haskell, our intern. If you're someone who has not seen Psycho and you don't know the twists, don't listen now. It's the only time I'll ever say this program, and go to the Little next Tuesday, because most people now, I think, know the twists, etc. And it is, I would be very, very curious to see what somebody in 2016 thinks, seeing it start to finish, knowing nothing about it. So you've got a chance to do that next Tuesday night. And then there's a panel discussion about the psychology of Psycho, but also editing techniques, how filmmakers do that, how they sort of play with our minds. Let me welcome our guests for the hour who are going to get our stage set for next Tuesday. Bree Merkel is the special events manager for the Little Theater, so she's going to make sure we're all set on what's going on next week, and we're going to have some fun this hour. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
When's the first time you saw Psycho?
In film school when I was about 19 years old.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the 1998 version with Vince Vaughn, we just pretend that never happened, right?
Yeah, I saw that in the theater, but yes, let's pretend it didn't happen.
I don't know what happened there. Les Friedman's here. Dr. Friedman's a professor and the former chair of the Media and Society Program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Les, nice to see you in studio as well.
Oh, thanks for the invite.
When's the first time you saw Psycho?
Well, this will date me. In the theater. And I must say, it's the only movie ever that I had to at one point get up and walk out of and come back.
Out of fear?
Oh, absolutely out of fear.
So it worked on Les. And Dr. James Cutting is on the line with us. He's the chair of the Department of Psychology at Cornell University. Dr. Cutting, what a perfect name for Psycho, and also talking about editing techniques. We couldn't have picked it any better. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thanks.
Your first time seeing Psycho, do you remember?
I was just thinking, you know, I don't even know. It was fairly early. I'm sure, my guess is probably in the 70s or 80s. I would have been a little young to have seen it. My parents wouldn't let me have gone.
Well, it was, interestingly, I'm kind of going back and reading the history of Psycho, and Megan Mack, our producer, you watched the whole thing last night, Meg, is that right? So I'm going to actually pull Megan here and there, because I've seen it a couple of times, but not for a little while. I watched a few of the scenes this morning, but just going back over the history of it, you know, Les, I'm reading that initially the critics thought there were kind of a split on it. Some thought, right, well, this wasn't very subtle, and but by the time the massive public response was known to the critics, they seem to be on board. Is that a fair history approximation?
That is a fair history. And what they noticed very early on, and why Psycho is important in the history of the horror film, is that before this time, the monsters, the evil person, the killer was always distant, sometimes even an alien, obviously, mm-hmm. in the science fiction film. Psycho brought horror into the family so that Anthony Perkins was quite literally the boy next door. And if he could be crazy and a killer, so could the boy who lived next to you.
Now, listen, I'm not a professional with this stuff, but I thought he was so good in this, wasn't he?
Fabulous in this.
Yeah, and I know we've got a few clips we'll get to as well. Bree, for you, we could kind of just do a whole discussion on just Psycho itself. We're going to get to the editing and the psychology, but what really works in this film for you?
I think that maybe it's just because I saw it in film class, and one of the first things that we talked about was how It's one of the maybe first and best examples of someone that you think is going to be a lead character dying within the first. Oh, right. Spoiler. Yeah, we're going to do
I've
that,
I've already
right?
warned people. If you haven't seen it, you're going to go next Tuesday. Don't be listening.
Okay, so okay. you know, dying within, what, the first third of the movie,
sure.
You know? And that's kind of a game changer when you look at traditional plot points in narrative film. So I always think about that. But, you know, there are so many iconic shots in that film, the blood going down the drain, you know, that I always think of that when I think of Psycho.
It's interesting you bring up the death of Janet Leigh's character because at that moment, you know, Les, the audience may be thinking, I'm sort of alone now in this film. You know, you know the main character. You figured you've got the main character throughout the film. She's gone, and you are kind of alone as a viewer in this strange and terrifying world here. So that probably had an interesting psychological effect.
Oh,
to begin with,
I think that is an incredibly powerful moment in the film. And in fact, we see it even working today. Let's say Game of Thrones. When Game of Thrones kills off a major character, there is a Twitter world goes a Twitter. As it were. You know, Evan, there's a funny story about this. Apparently Hitchcock, and I forget which, maybe Professor Cutting knows, he has made a film in which a character was killed in the bathtub, and then someone was killed in the shower, and someone wrote him and said, Mr. Hitchcock, I'm now afraid to take baths. Now you've made me afraid to take showers. What do you suggest? And Hitchcock, in his droll voice, said, perhaps you should go out and be dry cleaned.
And apparently Janet Leigh, after the movie, never owned a house that had a shower in it.
Really?
Wow.
That's great. Yeah.
You always wonder if those stories are apocryphal or not, but I had heard little bits on that. And so, Dr. Cutting, I want to ask you, you know, next week when you're at the Little Theater here and we're talking about these various aspects of creating psychological tension, et cetera. You've written a lot about editing and what filmmakers can do and how they can manipulate. You know, what are the lessons from Psycho for you?
Oh, I think what Hitchcock does so remarkably is to control the gaze of the viewer. Basically, his shots are quite spare. And the viewer doesn't have a whole lot to look at. And Hitchcock very much controls where he wants that to happen. And although there are no data on Psycho that I know of, there are data on eye movements in looking at one of the TV shows Hitchcock Presents. And it's clear that he controls the eye gaze of viewers much more than, say, the average sitcom or even the movie Good, Bad, and the Ugly or, you know, other things. So he's really controlling where people look.
Okay. Les, what would you say about that?
I think that's right. I always find it amazing when we think about that famous shower scene, as Dr. Cutting knows better than I, that the knife, you never see the knife cut flesh. And yet we all believe what's gone on in that scene. And I know I was just reading an article by Dr. Cutting where he talks about the Kuleshov experiment, where you basically, it demonstrates the power of editing. And that shower scene is classic in terms of this because it lets us fill in the blanks between the cuts.
Now, I was reading here. Let's see here. I'm trying to see that shower scene. It was 6 days of shooting, 77 or 78 different cameras, and the scene runs for about 3 minutes. It includes 50 different edits. 50
yeah.
different edits. So most of them
are. There's actually a stretch of 30 seconds in which the average shot duration is less than a second. It's only 800 milliseconds. So until the Anthony Perkins character leaves, and then there's these glorious long shots that last, you know, 15, 20, and 25 seconds afterwards. But yeah, I mean, it's just really cut to pieces. In a way that I can't claim to be a film scholar, but you know, there really aren't any other films that I know of that are cut that fast for, you know, let's say a half a minute, which is basically what the shower scene, the core of the shower scene is.
And when it comes to 1960, I mean, remember, we're talking about this 56 years later, less, but for 1960, was this a revolutionary approach to this? I mean, had we seen something like this?
Well, there had always been montages, obviously, but I think Dr. Cutting is right that I don't think we had ever seen anything like this. Though I do think we see it now more.
Yeah.
Teaching students, when I teach a history of film class and you do an early film, even an early classic film, Citizen Kane, or I'm doing a Western class right now, so I did John Ford. I did John Ford and then Peckinpah, and now I'm doing Eastwood. Students really have some trouble with the slowness, though it's beautiful, the pace of a John Ford film, because they're so used to cutting being fast now. And duration, I think you're right, the duration is far less now.
I had, you end up reading so much about Psycho. So much has been written about Psycho that, as I said, you start to wonder what becomes legend and what becomes real. But I had read that initially Hitchcock wanted no music, no nothing, and that the person who hired to do the composing, which, as Megan Mack grabbed that microphone, because Megan made, I thought, a great point. Megan, you were saying you thought one of the main characters was the sound, the music, right?
Absolutely. It's a character in itself. It tells you how to feel, what to expect. There's so much foreshadowing with the music in the film. And when I was watching it last night with a more critical eye, I thought, what would this be without any sound, without any music?
Well, let me ask Dr. Cutting and Les that question then. If you had Dr. Cutting, you had that shower scene without the sounds, and the actual sounds, I think, became known as the murder. Oh boy, I had it
right
here. I think it's called The Murder. But if you had it without the strings, those iconic strings now, what do you think the difference in terms of psychological impact would be, Dr. Cutting?
I think it would be tremendous. I mean, Bernard Herrmann's music is just astonishing. But what I can say is that there is a lot of Psycho in which it is silent. And that's true in many Hitchcock films where Hitchcock is clearly using the silence to put people on edge, basically. I mean, people are so used to music coming in now and again. I mean, the data that I have say that for, you know, the average film, there's music on in the background. We call it non-diegetic film music, and it's on about half the time. And I haven't looked at my data recently. I did look at Psycho and how much music it has, and it actually doesn't. There's a lot of blank space there, and Hitchcock uses it tremendously well. But then, of course, the shower scene, and there are many other scenes as well, particularly when they go up to the house on the hill. It's just full of this Bernard Herrmann wonderfully edgy stuff.
Les, what do you think would have been the difference without the music in the shower scene?
I think Dr. Cutting's absolutely right. I think the music is, and Megan is right as well. I think the music is absolutely crucial here. I'm amazed to hear that he didn't think about it, because he's used Herrmann. You know, he understands music. So it would have been a very, very, very different scene. I can't quite imagine it, actually.
I know, it is so hard to imagine. It is almost, Brie, as hard to imagine that scene without the music as it is to, when Star Wars came out, a lot of people were posting old Star Wars clips of the original 1977, and the Scottish-voiced actor who played Darth Vader under the mask thought his voice was actually going to be Vader before they grabbed James Earl Jones for the role.
Yeah.
And you can actually go back and watch a scene where it's got this sort of this meek Scottish voice, and it's ridiculous. And it's, to me, it would be just as jarring to hear not James Earl Jones as it would be not to have those strings there. Do you agree?
I'm Scottish, so I think that would have been amazing. But I completely think that, you know, it would change everything, but you can kind of understand it, right, when you think about Hitchcock. I mean, he's kind of like the Picasso of making people uncomfortable, right? So how uncomfortable would it be to sit in a theater that's completely silent for so long? You know, I do kind of understand. He was going for something so claustrophobic, and he was really trying to ramp up the fear in any way. Now, I love the music, as we all do, but I sort of get where he was going with it a little bit.
Yeah, interesting. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about not just Psycho for the hour, though. I think my fascination with Psycho is going to carry a good portion of this, just because the Little Theater is showing it a week from tonight. Bree, let our audience know what's coming up a week from tonight.
Yeah, so we're doing our first of our Science on Screen series for this year. Science on Screen is a national series that a bunch of different theaters around the country participate in, art house theaters. What's cool about this Tuesday is that it is the national Science on Screen night, so that means around the country all of the participating theaters are playing a film on the same evening. You can go to their website, and you can check out other cities if you're interested. But we'll be showing the movie at 6:30. All of our regular ticketing applies, so our discounts for members and students and seniors will still be there. And we're going to watch the movie, and then Dr. Cutting's going to do a discussion afterwards.
All right. Now, Megan Mack, producer, again, who had a chance to see the film last night. By the way, Meg, that wasn't the first time you've seen it, was it?
No, I saw it when I was a teenager.
Okay. So you pulled a couple of different clips of sound, including Hitchcock himself talking about on editing to create a shock. What are we about to hear?
Yeah, so in this clip, he's talking about The Private Detective and how he used editing techniques in that clip to convey shock. Yep, Val. I'm helping Val out. Yes, Hitchcock on editing. So he talks about how he's using different sizes of objects within shots to convey different emotions.
Okay.
So I have this man mounting the stairs in what we would call a medium shot, a waist shot, and he gets to the top of the stairs. Then I take the camera and put it very, very high, way, way high, above the ceiling almost, as though we're looking down on the whole thing. And a little figure runs out with a raised knife. And the hand goes up with the knife into the air and starts to bring it down. Now remember, these are two tiny figures. Then the next cut is a big head of the man as the knife goes across his face. Now, this is size of image put together to create shock. In other words, if it were music, it would be tremolos on the violin and suddenly a brass instrument, which is the big close-up. And from that he fell and went back. So there's an illustration of using the size of the image to create shock or whatever you will.
Very interesting. I'm going to start with you, Les, and we'll ask Dr. Cutting to comment on what you just heard from Hitchcock. What do you think?
I think it's great to hear him talk, first of all.
Isn't it so great?
It's just so fabulous to hear him talk. But that's a very telling analysis. You know, when I teach Hitchcock, we talk about the difference between suspense and shock. And Hitchcock, the master of suspense, understood it. He said it was easy to shock an audience. For example, a bomb goes off. But if you see a hand put a bomb in a baby carriage and that baby carriage being pushed through a park, that's suspense, because you as the audience know something is going to happen that the characters on the screen don't know. And in this case, when he's talking about the detective on the stairs, it is shock. But so much of Psycho, and we're not talking about the shower scene now because that's shock as well, but much of Psycho is you sort of having a sense of what's going to happen or even knowing what's going to happen, and the characters are unaware of the danger that they're in.
Okay. Dr. Cutting, what do you make of what you just heard from Alfred Hitchcock?
Well, I was actually trying to bring up the scene on my computer.
Yeah.
I've actually heard people complain about the overhead shot, that it's a little bit too cute. I think it has enormous effect, and of course what it does is hide any facial view of the perpetrator, which we know is Perkins character, and that too, and you know that helps with the suspense. And then it's actually the following shot that is a little bit interesting. And it's one of these things that probably doesn't age well. I mean, I think we have a kind of period eye, and in the 50s and 60s, and 70s, I think our expectations of film were a little bit different than they are today. So apparently the shooting of the film as the Martin Balsam character is attacked and goes down the steps. Apparently he was being carried in a chair, and so if you look at the what Martin Balsam is doing, he's basically falling down the stairs, but he's falling too smoothly. And so there are a couple interesting things that I think that this happens many times when you're watching a film for the second or third time. You notice things that you wouldn't have noticed before. But I sometimes wonder if in fact, I'm quite sure that as we've become a more visual society and we've seen more and more films and we've seen techniques in popular movies expand and get more sophisticated, I think we notice these kinds of things in older films that the then audiences wouldn't have noticed at all.
Wes, what do you think about that?
No, I absolutely agree, and I must admit that scene of Balsam going down the stairs is the one scene that rings false to me. And I've always thought, oh, Hitch, why did you do that?
Well, I think, to Dr. Cutting's point, part of the reason was we hadn't yet learned the actual identity of the killer and the scenario that was driving Norman. So that was one way for him to try to hide it. But interesting to hear both of you agree that today it kind of rings a little false. I wonder at the time, I mean, none of us go back to 1960, but what everybody was thinking at the time, if anybody was walking out the theater going, that was terrifying, but you know, that scene was a little cute. I mean, probably he got a little bit of a pass because of the rest of the film.
Oh, sure he did. Sure he did.
You know, for example, here's Danny writing to us on Twitter. Danny says, we laugh about it now, but I was so upset I cried in the bathroom after seeing the movie, and a woman saw how scared I was. She and her husband drove us home. Psycho wrecked us. That's from Danny.
Today we'd be afraid that they drove you home, the two people in the, that you didn't know drove you home.
Well, so we've been talking about Psycho, but there are plenty other films to discuss as we talk about the psychological impact of editing. And let me grab a phone call. Beth in Brighton wants to weigh in as we broaden the discussion.
Evan,
go ahead, Beth.
I just wanted to mention the shark on the cape.
The shark on the cape? Jaws?
Jaws,
yeah. And that music. And also Rear Window. The birds. So there are lots of amazing kinds of music that went with all those films that terrified me forever. And I just thought maybe your guests would have some thoughts about those movies and the music as well.
Well, Beth, thanks for the phone call. And I will just say, for me, my childhood, I remember screaming at my twin brother to turn it off when the end credits rolled and the ominous piano music came up for Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween. So that messed with me pretty good. So Dr. Cutting, she's bringing up Jaws, I think Rear Window, which I'm not familiar with, probably should be, among a few others there. She's talking about music, but I mean, we could also talk about editing, for example, in Jaws and the way that the camera angles work here. But go ahead,
sure.
Dr. Cutting,
I mean,
I'll start with you.
Jaws is particularly interesting because the shark is so bad as a simulation of a real shark, that they were they literally had to pare off frames of the of the shark, because it became very clear with a longer shot that this was just a big hunk of plastic. So they were in the editing room, they were very careful not to give you a good look at the shark, because it just was awful.
You know, in the form of a shameless plug, I have to say I've written a book on Spielberg called called Citizen Spielberg. There are many, many stories about the shark in Jaws. And in fact, as Dr. Cutting knows, the only person who won an Academy Award for Jaws was the editor, was Verna Fields. But what happens here is that, as everyone tells the story, the shark, named after Spielberg's lawyer, Bruce, was not working. And Spielberg was figuring, what can I do? And he came up with, of course, the brilliant solution after he had watched The Thing, an earlier movie, of not showing the shark. And he doesn't show the shark for, what, three quarters of the way through the film. And he felt that the shark would be the music. And the scene, and again, I'm sure Dr. Cutting knows it, my favorite editing scene in there is what's called the Bloody Beach scene, where the little boy on the raft is eaten by the shark. Spielberg felt that by the time three-quarters of the film had gone through and we had heard the music, you would buy whatever the heck the shark looked like. And we do, by and large.
And in many ways, Dr. Cutting, that sounds to me like a brilliant editing choice.
It was a
pragmatic choice because mm-hmm. the shark didn't really look believable. But by then, the terror was so strong that, mm-hmm. that maybe in the same way with Psycho, you were so scared that maybe your brain isn't going to take you out of it for kind of a silly falling down the stairs, too smooth
right.
kind of emotion. Maybe you get more of a pass if you can establish more of a psychological edge. Is that fair, Dr. Cutting?
I think that's completely true. I mean, the idea of withholding information to build tension is a wonderful device. And of course, as Les said, in the original movie The Thing in 1950 with James Arness playing the the creature from outer space, mm-hmm. you know, we never get to see The Thing for well over half the movie. And then all of a sudden there's this wonderful scene where we are confronted with the monster, and there's, as I remember, there's no music. The characters just open the door, it's silent, and then you see this creature. And the creature just looks like a very tall man.
You're right.
But then this amazing music comes on and just completely flushes you with terror. It's a marvelously edited, both in sound and in the visuals. It's a marvelous scene.
Now, our phones are lighting up with listeners who want to weigh in with their own takes on various films and
good.
Psychological mm-hmm. aspects. So I'm going to get back to the phones in just a second with Rich and Bill. But one more quick question for our panel before I turn it over to our listeners for much of the rest of the hour. And that's for Dr. Cutting and Les. You know, you mentioned in the shower scene in Psycho, you never see the knife enter flesh.
Right.
You mentioned in Jaws, for most of the film, you don't even see the shark. And, you know, far be it for me, I'm not an expert, but I do feel like in the gore genre, we've lost some of the subtlety, and that sometimes the best editing, the most psychologically manipulative stuff, is less is more. And Dr. Cutting, is that a general rule? Is there any reason for that? Psychologically, is there a reason that is it because our brains start to fill in the details that we can't see? What is it?
Well, I think what you hit on at the end is exactly right. I mean, basically, they're relying on imagination. And I think, you know, if you're prompted and you're given the right scaffolding of music and editing and other things, you can create in your mind more horrible things than anyone could put on the screen. And, you know, they're sort of coaxed the filmmakers, and this is the director, the cinematographer, the editor, they're all working in consort to have your imagination go wild. And that's it. I mean, you know, pictures of gore are, you know, fairly horrible, but they don't put you in the same state, I think, as the imagination can do.
Okay. Les?
Well, first of all, I've always believed that less is more, as you've mentioned. It's a joke, Evan. It's a small pun.
Thank you. I caught it.
Okay, good.
There was a reason I didn't react.
Okay. but let me... I think that we have become just overly obsessed with seeing gore and violence, and I think that it has become the new money shot in horror films. I mean, I got to tell you, I honestly can't go to most horror films. I mean, I just think the gore and the blood and audiences. Now, you have to understand the demographics of horror film. I mean, the demographics of horror film are mainly they're made for adolescent and very close to adolescent boys. That's the main audience for horror films. It wasn't the case, and Dr. Cutting's right, it was not the case in early horror films. Frankenstein, Dracula, even Jaws, that was for a mass audience. That was for men, women, all ages. Now, when you go to see these very popular horror films, it's almost exclusively the demographic is young boys.
Yeah, interesting. Brie, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, you know, I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about what you don't see. And I do think that if you try to think back about movies that were in the news that made an impact, all of them have that in common, that it's more about what you don't see. And one that came to my mind was, you know, it's kind of become a little bit of a joke at this point, but the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, I've brought it up before. I'm not going to apologize for saying that
I was
spooked
terrified.
Me very
yeah.
well because of all of those things.
Yeah, and when you think about the end of that film, it never even materializes, but it was a terrifying experience, and it's all about how that movie was shot and the atmosphere it created. So I think that those are the kind of horror films and thrillers that I like to watch, and I completely agree, gore not for me, but those are great.
I just taught The Exorcist, which still causes my students to turn away, and you just watch that and there is nothing held back in that film. And that's what, 74, 75, somewhere in there. And I think from that point, we get more and more overt in terms of the violence and the blood and the bodily secretions, which are a big part of horror films.
Yeah. But a great point from Les that those are aimed at a specific genre now. And it's a big genre. It's a big class of filmgoers, but it's not necessarily for everybody. All right, let's get a short break. And then Rich and Bill, next up, they want to ask about When a Stranger Calls, Pawnbroker, some other comments they want to jump in on. So we're going to get to them coming up with Dr. Les Friedman, professor and the former chair of the Media and Society program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Brie Merkel's in studio with me. She's a special events manager for the Little Theater. And Dr. James Cutting, the chair of the Department of Psychology at Cornell University. Your phone calls on the psychological effects in these movies next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, first hour, it's Sunshine Week. We're talking about transparency in government. Who's doing a good job and who's not? And how are reporters handling getting information? Then second hour, Michelle Norris joins us in studio. She's in Rochester for the day. Longtime NPR host and creator of the Race Card Project, Michelle Norris sits down with us on Connections. Talk with you Wednesday.
Shaka Sengor served 19 years in prison for killing a man in Detroit. At first, he racked up dozens of disciplinary violations behind bars, but he says mentors and reading helped him change.
I'm a firm believer in the power of the written word.
Now he's a spokesman for the idea that people can reform. His story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to tell you about two events coming to the Little Theater because that's what sparked, first of all, the first event we're going to tell you about is what sparked this discussion on psychological aspects of editing and filmmaking, the way filmmakers can sort of manipulate us with editing, with music, with all of these things that they really did so well in films like Psycho. We've been talking about Jaws and other things. So next Tuesday night, Brie Merkel from the Little Theater. What's happening at the Little next Tuesday?
It's the first installment of our Science on Screen series, and we're going to be playing Psycho, and we're going to have a discussion with Dr. James Cutting afterwards. And it's our regular ticket pricing. You can check our website for more details.
Okay. Tomorrow night, I also briefly want to ask the audience to come join us tomorrow night. Tomorrow night at the Little Theater. This is a separate event, but let me just briefly mention it because we mentioned it a couple weeks on the program, but now the event's upon us. So tomorrow night, it's sort of the reverse. We're going to be having a panel discussion and then a film, and it starts at 6 p.m., and I hope you'll come out tomorrow night because here's the setup. In 1970, a local photographer by the name of Mark Brady, he was 26 years old, and like a lot of people his age, he'd gone to Woodstock, had all the good vibes, you know, but then sort of had to figure out what to do with his life. He became a photographer, but before he kind of embarked on his career, he and his best friend went on a cross-country road trip. Hmm. They rented an old VW microbus until it broke down, and then they hitchhiked the rest of the way. And what they did was they took hundreds of photographs of our country all over the country, some natural photography, some beautiful scenes, some very human scenes, and he put it all together. 40 years later, he finds all these slides, and they're beautiful, and they're pristine, and he puts them together in a book, and it's a chance for us to see 1970 America and kind of compare it to how things are now. What's the same? What's different? How have things changed? Why don't we hitchhike anymore? You know, because we really don't. But back then, you certainly could, and you did. And so we thought we'll have a conversation about the music of the time, the protest songs, photography, how it has changed, road trips, American culture, and then what's better than maybe the most underrated 1970 film, which is a film called Five Easy Pieces. And Les, I know you've said you love the film. I've still never seen it. I've only seen one scene in it. It's a Jack Nicholson film that probably doesn't get the run that a lot of his films do.
No. It really is a fabulous film, and it really defines in all sorts of ways the characteristics that then came about to define the rest of the 70s.
So if you haven't seen Five Easy Pieces, you can see it tomorrow night after we have a fun discussion. And you get a chance to see this great photography that's actually hanging in the gallery now at the Little Theaters Cafe. So I hope you will come out tomorrow night, 6 p.m. at the Little Theater, and do that. And
is he going to have the book there?
He's going to have the book there.
Oh, good.
Yep. And Les, I know Les gave me a hard time for having not seen Five Easy Pieces.
Right.
So that's my first chance to see it tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. So last quick comment on that. Why is this, you know, such an underrated film? What makes it a great film?
I think it's because people were not ready for the structure of that film, which is very episodic. It's a character study more than a narrative-driven film in the traditional Hollywood manner.
Mm-hmm. Roger Ebert said one of the five greatest American characters created on screen, created by Jack Nicholson.
Wow.
So we hope that you will come see it tomorrow night at the Little Theater. So a lot going on. Tomorrow night, the Little Theater for that. Next Tuesday for Psycho and discussion on psychology. And let's get back to the phones. This is Rich in Rochester. Rich, go ahead.
First, I just want to make one little comment about horror. I think some of the gore is the easy way out on films. And then I remember the movie When a Stranger Calls. I don't know if any of you saw it when it first came out. I was a big watcher of, you know, all the horrors of the 60s and 70s. I found that movie to be unnerving because of the timing of it and that one of the last scenes when he calls the girl at the restaurant. I mean, I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was a chilling movie.
Rich, forgive me. Is When a Stranger Calls, is that the phone calls coming from within the house? Is that?
Yes, that's the way it starts.
Oh, that's how it's... Okay, see, I haven't seen it. I know the iconic story because summer camp, some version of that was always told. Just as a gory movie called The Hitcher was turned into a summer camp story. But Rich, thanks for the phone call. Les, so what do you make of When a Stranger Calls?
I don't make anything.
No?
Because
no?
I haven't seen it.
Oh,
I'm sorry you caught me, Rich. Good job.
Okay. Dr. Cutting, have you seen it?
No, I'm in the same department as Les.
Well, Rich, you've given us some homework to check that out. But Dr. Cutting, on Rich's larger point, that he thinks gore is the easy way out. Is that a fair description most of the time?
I don't see these movies either. But I think there's a sense, I mean, it depends on what the filmmaker is after. If they want, I could easily imagine, as Les says, the teenage boy, this is exactly what they want to see.
Well,
in some sense, they're not particularly interested in the sophistication of the narrative argument that's going on around this particular situation. And of course, in high contrast to that, it's that sophistication that people like Hitchcock and other people who are making thrillers and other things are exactly playing with. So, you know, I think if the filmmaker knows his or her audience, they know what to deliver.
Well, here's Chris on Twitter on the subject of gore. He talks about the movie Seven. And Chris writes, "What's in the box? The unseen finale of Seven trumps all of the previous gore in the film."
Absolutely. He's absolutely right. I mean, Seven's a throwback in that sense. But, you know, when we talk about this issue of gore, you have to understand that movies as a mass popular culture medium both reflect and indeed shape society. So what's going on? We can't just look at them in isolation. So, for example, we've become more accustomed to gore. I always go back and think of the 70s as evolving because of Vietnam. We see Vietnam on television every night. We see people being killed in our living rooms as we're eating dinner. And that never happened into American society. I mean, just go through the 60s and Kent State. And then couple that with the distrust, what we're talking about, what we'll talk about tomorrow night, but couple that with the distrust of political institutions, Watergate, things like that. So that movies tend to be able to sort of plug into the zeitgeist of that particular mm-hmm. era. And, you know, all you have to do is put on HBO or even regular television now, premium television, to see things you would have never seen 20 years ago, particularly sex and violence.
And by the way, I have not seen Seven. Bree, you were nodding, though, at Chris's comment there on Seven.
Oh, yeah, Seven. I mean, when he started, you know, mm-hmm. talking about the scene, I immediately got that sense of panic again, because the last scene in Seven is so terrifying. I've watched it probably 20 times, and it's all about what you don't see once again. But the whole tone of that movie, I mean, David Fincher is just so amazing at creating this sense of unease. And I think that's one of his best examples of that.
Dr. Cutting, were you also agreeing on Seven?
Yes. That the I mean, you sort of know what's happening as soon as the UPS truck is delivering something in the middle of nowhere. And then when you see the size of the box, I mean, it's almost, you know, you're horrified, and you try to second guess that, no, it can't be that. And it's pretty astonishing. It's just very powerful.
All right, back to the phones. Bill in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Evan. I have to bring up, I can't fail to bring up, after hearing this conversation, one of the most seldom referenced but groundbreaking movies, called The Pawnbroker, which Rod Steiger should have won the Academy Award for. But it was a dark edge film, and it starts out with this idyllic, slow motion picnic on this beautiful valley in Germany where this Jewish family is having a picnic, and bang, in triple fast action, the Gestapo come and take the family away. And later on, in the pawnbroker's cell in this ghetto area where Rod Steiger is a prisoner, he has these subliminal flashbacks to these horrors and the Holocaust. It's such a brilliant film. I think that wonderful scene, jumping off the cliff in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, wouldn't have occurred without this movie. So I'd be interested in your thoughts from your experts.
Bill, thanks for calling. Go ahead, Les Friedman.
Yeah, I know this film really well. And it's interesting that you call it a horror film. And by the way, Rod Steiger won the Academy Award next year. The next year, I think the Academy was paying him back that he should have won. In fact, I think, if my faulty memory is good, I think that was the year Lee Marvin won for Cat Ballou, but could be off.
And
on
Steiger
the
was a makeup job award the next year.
Yeah. He won it for In the Heat of the Night. Okay. I mean, it was very good. But to get back to it, it's interesting that the caller puts this into the horror film, because of course the monsters are real. The monsters are the Nazis. And again, I must say, I go back to my teaching experience. This is an older film, and yet it maintains its power in all sorts of ways. And I don't know what Dr. Cutting thinks, but I think the reason that it does work in particular is the editing and the flash cuts back to his time in the concentration camp and seeing his wife raped and seeing what happens to his best friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a horror film, but its horror is quite real. Mm.
Dr. Cutting?
Yeah, it's a very powerful movie. I haven't seen it in many years, but I do remember the flashes of flashbacks, mm-hmm. if you will. But for me, the most powerful scene in it, if I'm remembering correctly, is where in the pawn shop himself, he's got this the classic device that had this pin sticking up through it where you put the receipts on top.
Mm-hmm. The spindle, yeah.
Yeah, and he just slams his hand down on top of it.
We have the phone still just kind of going nuts here. People want to weigh in, and so we're going to get to, for the next 8 minutes, we're going to get as many calls as we can, and if you don't get in, well, you know where to go next Tuesday night at the Little Theater here. Next up is Max. Go ahead, Max.
Hi, Evan. Excellent show, as always.
Thanks.
Loving this one. A recent horror movie that came out 2015, which was masterful in its use of music and editing, was It Follows. I saw that at the Little, actually.
Yeah,
and
I was going to mention
there wasn't excessive violence, and it was an absolutely terrifying film. And it's a rare example of, in a genre today that is just dominated by excessive violence, that careful editing, a well-made story, and proper tone was amazing. And I just wonder if your panel knows anything about that.
So, Max, stay here for 1 second and let Bree jump, because I know you were nodding. So did you get, I know it was at The Little, did you get a chance to see it too?
Yeah, and it was one of my favorite movies last year too. And it is totally kind of that throwback where there are some things that you see, but you never really understand it. And whatever this sort of killer monster is something that is not a form. It basically takes over any person, or any, I think it's just person, I don't think animals, but yeah, it's a great one. And one thing that I've noticed, just, you know, we look at a lot of movies coming up at The Little, and when I go, I work for Sundance and I do the midnight shows there, so that's mostly horror genre. There does seem to be a trend towards more of the what you don't see style of horror film, which is great for me. There was a really wonderful Iranian horror film that will probably be out sometime next year. I think it was called Under the Shadows, and it's the same sort of idea where it's back to kind of those ghost stories and you know, what's around the corner. So I think it's kind of a really exciting time, especially for independent horror films.
Max, I haven't seen It Follows, but the notion of something inhabiting something else isn't necessarily the newest concept. So what about the film really worked for you?
So sort of what was just said, you don't really ever know what it is. And it's the most, basically, this girl who we're following, she has sex with some guy, and he, like, knocks her out with some chloroform, and she wakes up, she's tied up, and he's like, listen, I'm not going to hurt you, but there's something following you now, and it's not going to stop until you pass it along to somebody else. And you pass along by having sex with somebody.
Oh, boy.
And it seems like a really stupid concept, but it's so well done. And it's just, the music was excellent, the way it was edited, and it's just always this shadow slowly following you, getting closer and closer, and it never will stop.
You know, the critics saw that as an AIDS allegory.
Oh.
I thought that too. I was like, I wonder if this is like an anti-AIDS sentiment here.
Wow. Max, thanks for the phone call. That's not one that was on my radar, but only because I've got a young child. Otherwise, I'm at The Little all the time. So I should have known. I'm writing down It Follows. We've got about 5 minutes left here, so let's keep going here. John Geneseo next up. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, thanks. And I really appreciate the show. Really appreciate everything. It's been great. I was listening, and I thought of a possible connection when they mentioned Janet Leigh in Psycho. It made me think, and I just want to put a quick disclaimer out. If anyone has not seen Scream, then please don't pay attention to what I'm about to say. But I was wondering if the panel could maybe comment on, and if they've seen it, the same sequence of events seems to play out with the main character in Scream, with Drew Barrymore. She also has a similar look to Janet Leigh, but she is dispatched in a much more on-camera, violent way, and I was wondering if maybe there was a connection there between maybe Wes Craven giving a nod back to Psycho, but then also updating it with a bit more violence for that time. So that was just my thought.
John, thanks for the phone call. Les?
Yeah, well, everybody who does horror films watch Hitchcock, and Craven has talked about, you know, that fact. And the caller's absolutely right. I mean, it's a nod back, it's an allusion back, with more humor, as I recall, right?
Yeah, I think Scream was certainly meant to be a little cheekier.
Yeah, yeah, a parody, yeah, almost.
A little bit. Brie?
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be kind of an homage to everything that came before it. So, yeah, I'm sure that that's in there. Although I do think that, you know, and this could even be a show on its own too, but there's that whole final girl theory in horror films.
Last girl standing.
Which is kind of the opposite of the final girl theory, is that there's always, in most slasher films, one woman who ends up surviving at the end of a film, and she's usually a virgin, and, you know, kind of when she's around all of these crazy other characters. But Janet Leigh actually is kind of the antithesis of that, right? Because she's gone not very far into it. But I'm sure that Wes Craven was influenced by
that. Well, go one step further. Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis, Janice Lee's daughter, is indeed the embodiment of the last girl standing theory.
1979, I think, John Carpenter. All right, John and Henrietta. Go ahead, John. Oh, John, you've got... Oh, man. Sorry, John, you can't have the radio up. I appreciate the phone call, and we're a little tight on time there. But just a quick reminder to listeners, if you're calling on and you're on the line, try to be listening to the phone and not the radio. But John, I promise we'll get back to you on a different day here, because Les is going to be here, Bree's going to be here. You can meet Dr. Cutting next Tuesday night. Dr. Cutting, a question from a listener off air. She called in to say, let's see here, Catherine from Greece called in to ask, why is it that people get so scared that they laugh? Dr. Cutting, you want to answer that?
It's a wonderful question, and I'm not sure I can give any educated answer. There's a related phenomenon that happens in movies that people have talked a lot about, and I haven't seen any appropriate answer, but that is, you're at a horror film, and you're scared, the bejesus is scared out of you, but you know that you're perfectly safe.
That's right.
I mean, so there's this conflict between, I mean, you know, there's this stuff up on the screen, and, you know, nobody's going to come out of the theater and, you know, out of the screen, and except for in certain movies, to harm you. So there's this kind of conflict. So I think we often laugh in situations where we're just stressed, or we have tension, and it's a way to relieve tension. So we do laugh at strange times. So yeah, I mean, if you laugh when you're horrified or whatever, it depends.
All right. Well, Dr. Cutting, in about 30 seconds, what do you want to talk about next Tuesday night? You're going to watch Psycho with the crowd at the Little. I know the audience will have a lot of things to talk about. What are you looking forward to talking about?
Well, most of the stuff that I'm able to talk about in any knowledgeable way is the editing. I've studied the editing of the films that come before Psycho and in that era and after Psycho, and noted the changes that have occurred, and that's probably what I know most about. But I do want to, I will say that I'm interested in eye movements, and I will talk about eye movements.
Very good. And by the way, I also read that Janet Leigh, one of the hardest scenes to shoot was the end of the murder scene in the shower, because as Dr. Cutting said, you had all those quick edits, and then you had that long, slow shot of the eye, but her eye had to stay open with water coming down, and she had a hard time with that, and Hitchcock told her, you're going to have to get this done. So apparently that was one of the ones that took the longest, but very effective. So,
oh, yeah.
Dr. Cutting, thanks for taking the time to join us, and we will see you at the Little Theater next Tuesday night.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Dr. James Cutting, Chair of the Department of Psychology at Cornell University. Les Friedman, I'll see you at the Little Theater tomorrow night for five easy pieces and a discussion on 1970s America then and my 2016 America now.
Peace, man.
did you ever hitchhike, by the way?
I did hitchhike, I must say, and I was saying the story to someone else that I was hitchhiking through Europe and they wouldn't pick up Americans because of Vietnam, and I sewed a Canadian flag on my backpack to try to get away with it.
Just to get away with it. Well, we'll have a lot to talk about. I'll see you tomorrow night at the Little Theater.
Will.
Thanks, Les. That's 6 o'clock tomorrow at the Little Theater. And Bree, you got so many things going on at the Little. Thanks for making the time for the program to come in and talk Psycho and film.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
A lot of fun. Thanks for all the phone calls. Let's listen a little of that wonderful score of the film, and we will talk with you Wednesday.